that are tremendously strong. And so you could have an almost dead receiver and a really bad antenna. And you could literally use a clip lead connected to the antenna when the 10-meter band opens up, and you'll be hearing beautiful signals. So Mother Nature has done that for you. Right now you're hearing a heterodyne from somebody who is doing some jamming, and please go to the reverse mode and tell us what you hear, and report it at RFI@Limehawk.org. Tell us how strong it was, what direction. When you go to the reverse mode, you're listening to the input, and also give us pretty accurate time as to when you heard it. And by that way, Eric and Andy and the other guys who are doing direction finding can put that information back together with the other information and figure out where it's coming from. The FCC expects us to do our own cleaning up of our own nest, if you know what I mean. They're limited in resources. If you and I can convince our congressman, let me drop. If we can convince our congressman to devote more energy, more dollars to the FCC, where they can have more resources, more people with direction finding equipment, then this problem will become considerably better. Way back in, let's say, 1965 or so, the FCC had a lot of monitoring equipment, direction finding equipment at their disposal, and they had a lot more resources being given to them by Congress in those days compared to today. And you and I wish that would be a better off. The next person on the list was Bill, KC2, Sierra Yankee Lima. Go right ahead, Bill, K2RIW in the TechNet. Receiver, which can receive 100 kilohertz to long wave band, over bleed from CBS 880 AM station. I was wondering if I could put something around the antenna wire, and the antenna is basically a long wire, 20 to 30 feet long, just hanging out the window. A choke or something to mitigate the interference from WCBS 880 FM and possibly some other strong AM stations in the neighborhood in order to listen to the long wave stations out of Europe. Back to net. Anybody who lives in a metropolitan area where quite often there are some very strong signals from broadcast stations and taxi cabs and dispatching services and so on, and fire and police and whatever, can easily get, depending on the dynamic range and filtering capability of your receiver, what your receiver you use and its blocking range or instantaneous dynamic range, third order intercept point. These are fancy words which tells you how strong an adjacent signal can be tolerated by your receiver before the receiver goes haywire. That's one of the variables. And there's various ways you can make improvement in the receiver itself. That part's not easy. When there's a particular frequency region you want to listen to, with the right kind of a band pass filter, and there are ways you can homebrew without too much expense, a band pass filter for your favorite HF frequency region. You can build a band pass filter, connect it between the antenna and the receiver, and it allows only those frequencies to go through and rejects everything else. That's the Cadillac approach. The poor man's approach to that would be if there is one or two very specific frequencies you know of that are giving you grief and essentially no others, then to build a stub tuner, to build a stub notch filter is amazingly easy. What does a stub notch filter look like? Let me describe that one. 880 megacycles is approximately one and a fraction. Wait a minute now. It's around 3 meters, 3 1/2 meters. If somewhere along the transmission line going to your antenna, you put a T-connector, and off to one side on the T-connector, you choose the right length of an open-circuited piece of coax cable. And if you make that piece of coax cable, wavelength long, it will give you a very deep notch at, say, 88 megacycles. And it will have almost no effect at almost all other frequencies. Once again, I'd like you guys to listen to the input. Tell us what you hear. How strong is the signal on the input when you go to the reverse mode in your rig? Write down the time and what you heard. If you've got a directional antenna, what direction is it coming from? And report that to rfi@limoc.org. So once again, getting back to the question that was given to us by Bill, to build a notch filter for one or two frequencies, and you're allowed to cascade these notches. In other words, another key connector further up the transmission line allows you to build a notch filter for 88 megs and 108 megs. There would be two separate notch filters, for instance, if that's what you want to do. So at a specific frequency, to notch out that frequency and have essentially no effect on the other frequencies you want to listen to. Pretty easy to do. So coax, stub, notch, filter. You Google words like that, various combinations of those words. You'll find out how to do it. And if you have trouble finding that, come back and ask us the question again next week. So one or two frequencies that are strong and very specific. Let me drop it. One or two very specific frequencies that are strong that you want to notch out. Relatively easy to do. And there's a whole lot of them. If you happen to live near Empire State Building, where there's a zillion transmitters, so to speak, then a notch filter is out of the question. You need a healthy bandpass filter in that case, which can be homebrewed. There's some commercial ones you can buy. Are they going to sell one for your particular frequency region that you care about to listen to? And that may be a little bit of a problem. To homebrew it is not too difficult. There are various articles in Radio Amateur's Handbook, among other places, on how to build a bandpass filter. And there's a little bit of mathematics involved. I didn't say it's super simple. So the right kind of filtering is probably the best approach. The Cadillac approach would be to drastically increase the dynamic range of your receiver. That requires a fair amount of redesign. There was a company in England, I can't think of the name of them right now, that used to sell kits that you could add to the popular transceivers of the day where they would drastically increase the dynamic range. In other words, the tolerance of strong adjacent signals would be drastically increased if you used one of their kits. I wonder if anybody remembers the name of that company. And maybe it's only academic. They might not be in business anymore. Anybody remember that name? K2RIW and the TechNet. That's what it looks like. They've been out of business, I think, now for quite a few years, so therefore people don't remember the name. So any undesired signals coming into a receiver, coming into a particular location, by way of the right kind of filtering, adjusting dynamic range, orientation of the antenna, directivity of the antenna, almost every radio interference problem is solvable. I didn't say it's simple. It's going to require some homework and some elbow grease, if you know what I mean. But don't give up. Every single undesired frequency reception problem is solvable. In the days when people used to be getting television interference, as long as the owner of the television and the local hams were enthusiastic enough to hang in there, every one of those was a solvable problem, Bill. KC2SYL, and please come back and tell us what you find out. K2RIW and the TechNet, you've got it, Bill.
To a research, basically a notch filter. I'll do the research on it. It's specifically that 880 AM. I was able to receive the long wave from Europe at one time, but every time I tried to receive it, with my track here, the signal, the 880 AM signal is so powerful it just knocks everything out. But you give them plenty of information to look up and to research. Back to Ned, and once again, thanks, Dick.
Yeah, another comment I should make here, Bill, and that is, I wrote down what you said, 880 megahertz, kilohertz, which is the AM band, and I misread my own notes, and I read that as 88 megahertz, the FM band. 88 megs FM band to use a quarter wave coaxial stub tuner, very appropriate, and a reasonable length of coax. You come down all the way to 8/10 of a megacycle, the coax cable is going to get quite long, and that may not be the best approach. Still worth considering it. An inexpensive piece of RG8U, the right length, would do it very nicely. However, down at 88 880 kilohertz, the right kind of filter might be a notch filter. Again, you could install it on the T connector, but in this case, it's going to be an inductor and a capacitor in series, a so-called series resonator. In other words, an inductor and a capacitor going from center conductor to ground, hanging off to one side of the T connector, will present a dead short circuit at that exact frequency, and essentially an open circuit at all other frequencies. So now you might want to use an LC network instead of a quarter wavelength of coax cable on the T connector, because it's we're talking about 100 times lower in frequency now. That would be 100 times longer with coax, and it's getting a little bit unwieldy. So maybe it's time to do it with a shielded LC. But every one of these is solvable, and the notch filter you're looking for, guaranteed, is you Google those words, and you're going to find quite a few nice solutions to it, Bill, and let us know what you find. Next person on our list was some guy named Paul, Whiskey Sierra 2 November, our space expert. But he's got a real radio question. He's going to give us more information from last week. Go ahead, Bill. KQIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. Just want to follow. Yeah, we'll do NASA later, but just want to follow up on last week's topic with the. I wanted to make an antenna. Let's call it a little tiny pipe structure for a mag mount, mag mount that normally sits on the top of the car. So you might remember that discussion. I have a piece of 1.5 inch PVC pipe, and I want to put it on top. And your advice was to gain that counterpoise that you lose when you take it off the roof of a car, was to put a 19-inch distance of tape going down the side of the PVC, and then mount the mag mount on top of it. And, you know, I thought I was going to use either a cookie can or whatever it is, but it turns out I used a coffee can, which worked out quite well. And I put the antenna on top of that, and I ran a quick test on this repeater, and it worked out okay. And then after putting it together, stabilizing everything, I wanted to stabilize that coffee can. I wanted to do it in a way, let me drop it. In a way where, you know, anybody can do it. If you want to take it camping or something like that, you know, I didn't want to get too fancy with a quarter-inch rod and nuts and things to stabilize this can. So I took a rather simple approach and very inexpensive where anybody can afford it. And it works. And put it in the backyard, put my lounge chair out there, and went on and on about a half hour for one test, and did it again a few hours later for about a half hour. I mean, if I went for a half hour, I don't have an SWR meter here. That's the only bad thing. But if I went for a half hour transmitting back and forth, and I didn't blow up my HT, my ICOM ICB-8, I think it's probably okay. But yeah, I did all that, Dick. If you want any details, I'll let you know. Back to that, WS2N.
Yeah, earlier today, I believe I heard you traveling mobile out at Watermill, Long Island, way out east on the North Fork. Oh, no, is that the North Fork? Yeah, I think it is, Watermill. Let me think, is that North Fork? I'm not sure now. And you were talking back through this particular eastern end repeater, which is now tied together radio-wise, so there isn't the normal delay between the two repeaters. And I heard you saying that the first time you used your PVC tubing, it was not quite as stiff as you'd like. I think you would, you may know that when it comes to selecting a piece of tubing, whether it be a PVC tubing or whether it be aluminum tubing, you get a hell of a lot more times stiffness when you increase the diameter of the tubing than when you increase the thickness of the tubing. So diameter makes a big difference. And there's various ways of stiffening. So I know that we were giving you various suggestions last week of using a bicycle wheel as a counterpoise, and either a straight, wide piece of so-called 500-mile-an-hour aluminum tape, and things like this. I think you're going to get the biggest bang for the dollar out of one single vertical piece of tape that's properly grounded right at the antenna, acting as counterpoise. And so how did that experiment go? And give us some further words on that one, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW in the second man.
Okay, Dick, WN. And that was not me driving around out there. I don't know who that was, but no, I was in the backyard, took a mobile antenna, put it on top of a, one of these 2-pound coffee cans, and put that on top of the inch and a half PVC pipe. Now, to make this pipe where it doesn't rattle around, you can't just put it on. It's almost 4 inches in diameter. To do that, I used, first of all, I put the tape down, three passes of aluminum tape. And like I said last week, I did check in the auto store. You could buy it in an auto store for about $6. You could buy the same stuff in Home Depot for half the price. But either way, it's inexpensive. I had the tape, put it on an inch and a half, Schedule 40 PVC DWB, and 10-foot long. You can buy these things 10-foot long. Mine was a full length, like 20 feet. I just cut it down to 10 feet, similar to what you would buy in a store for $4.95 in Home Depot, and put the can on top of that. But inside the can, I took styrofoam. Now, the styrofoam you can get anywhere, of course. You could maybe use old styrofoam from an older piece of equipment that you might have gotten to get a force from the store, or like what I did. I went over to Michael's. Anybody's familiar with artwork and things, store Michaels has a lot of weird things, and one thing that they have is regular styrofoam, and different shapes, and they have circles and spheres and this and that, and you can make things out of it. And they had a regular 28 by 12 inch, 1 inch thick board, for only $6.99. Funny, when I was working, I was tripping over this stuff, but here I am out buying it. And then made two circles out of that, 4 inches. Pushed one all the way into the coffee can, all the way in. And then, in that sphere, cut out in that cylinder piece, I cut an inch and a half, well, really 2-inch hole for outside diameter.
We gotta get on with the show.
And that was for the outside diameter. And then another one on the bottom. Push that in. Antenna on top. And then just a couple of pieces of duct tape. Might be put on the mag mount is about three and a quarter inch diameter. And that's it. Pretty much worked. Any longer pipe than that, you would need to extend the coax. Instead of getting budget report that I normally get with an APC and a rubber duck, I got a deadbolt sliding report. So there you go, Dick.
So with a deadbolt sliding report on the Eastern repeater from your QTH in Ronkonkoma. Good sounding antenna you got there with that very expensive materials. Well done, Paul, and good luck with that antenna. I'm going to move on now to John, who's got a question, and I'm going to have some fun with John. John, I'll answer a question about anything except bird watt meters and the 100 milliwatt type of slugs that go with them. What would you like to ask, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, hi. Hear me, Dick, over this nonsense. Yes, I was on the phone to Bird for about 45, 50 minutes last week, and had a few questions for them concerning the work I'm doing with my Bird meter. But they answered a question which we've been kicking about on the net as far as reversing a slug, and when you have a dual element watt meter, the proper use of slugs. Now, everybody knows when you're looking at, say, 100 watts, and you're looking at the forward power, and you want to look at a finely resolved element of your reverse power, they would go to a lower slug. Well, it is okay, but you have to maintain a tenth ratio. So if you have a 100-watt slug in forward, it is okay to use a 10-watt slug in the reverse mode. And that can be continuous operation. That's something I found out, which I was wondering, because a lot of people have damaged meters by doing exactly what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. So I thought that information would be interesting for the hams who want have dual meters or using two meters and want to watch both episodes at the same time. So back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, this is a darn good question, John, which has an area of a lot of misunderstanding for a lot of people. Let's call it proper use of a Berg watt meter. And even before you get into the dual slug type Berg watt meter, just the ordinary simple Berg model 43A that a lot of guys use, here's a typical situation that I've heard so often. A guy is building himself a real carefully constructed moon bounce antenna for 2 meters or 432, and he's putting 1500 watts of power into it. He's carefully tuning the antenna to be as close as possible to 50 ohms resistor, because when he does that, he gets the highest performance out of his low noise amplifier. When he's in the receive mode, you need an extremely high performance low noise amplifier to listen to those very weak signals coming back from the moon. At 432, that signal you send back to the moon comes back to you 263 decibels weaker than what you sent. And if you don't have a state-of-the-art, super-sensitive receiver that can hear somebody strike a match on the moon, if you know what I mean, I'm exaggerating. Unless you've got a super-sensitive receiver like that, you're not going to hear that moon bounce echo. It really separates the men from the boys. It's the edge of the art of what ham radio operators can do, moon bounce. The first time it was done by Fort Monmouth in New Jersey, they were using a zillion-dollar radar to do that first echo of the moon right after World War II. Good job. So it ain't easy, all right? So here's the scenario. The guy's carefully tuning. He doesn't happen to have an ideal antenna analyzer or vector network analyzer that he can mount right at the antenna on top of the tower, if you know what I mean. He's measuring standing wave ratio very carefully in a shack. So he's putting 1,500 watts forward, and he wants to get 100 milliwatts coming back. Okay? So very tempting is that you take the 1,500-watt full-scale slug, you put it into the Berg watt meter, you read forward power, and you say, 1,500 watts is going up the line, and that line happens to be inch and a half Andrew Heliax, air-filled, dry nitrogen-filled, you know, real super good signal. A very low loss transmission line, inch and a half diameter, and I think the stuff is $5 a foot back in the days when I used to be buying it. Anyhow, and then he wants the power coming back to be a small fraction of a watt, and with a 1500 watt forward reading slug, and you turn it reverse, the slug goes down, the needle goes down to zero, and you don't see anything, and he wants to resolve the fine details. So he unplugs the 1500 watt slug, and he plugs in a 1 watt slug. In that case, he's making a 150-to-1 ratio? No, 1,500-to-1 ratio. And now I'm going to tell you why you should not exceed the 10-to-1 ratio that you just mentioned. There's some very good physics on that. So he plugs in his 1-watt slug, looking for 1-watt of reverse power when he's putting 1,500 watts. What he's done is very common sense sounding. Until you dig into what is the slug on the Berg watt meter. Let me drop. And if you get a chance to read the article that I wrote, 1,500 words or so, on the subject of directional couplers used for standing wave ratio measurements, and that slug of a Berg watt meter, whether you know it or not, it is the directional coupler. Most of the directional couplers we see as a flea market device is Nauter is one of the most popular brand names. It's an object that's about 8 inches long, about 3 inches wide, about an inch high, and it's got three type N connectors on it, and that's called a directional coupler. It's a coaxial device. You take it apart inside, and you find that it's built with high-power strip line inside. Okay. That's a real directional coupler. You There are ways you can miniaturize that and squeeze it into the slug of a bird watt meter, and they've done it. But the way a directional coupler works, if you get a chance to read that article that used to be in the K5RMG website, K5 Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5 Rodeo Mike Golf, is the group that used to have this article by K2RIW in the so-called technical section. I'm very disappointed that they've redone their website in the last 6 months, and those technical articles have been eliminated. But by way of the Wayback file, now you know that it used to be there more than a year ago. K5RMG.org, I think it is the name of the group, Roadrunners Microwave Group of North Texas. And you, by the Wayback file, you can find the way their website used to look. You can find the technical articles. At the bottom of the technical articles, you'll find the K2RIW corner. And you look at that article on directional couplers. And for somebody who really needs a copy of it and can't find it by the procedure I just told you, you send me an email and I'll send you a copy of that article. And it'll take you a little while to study it, but I've done a pretty good job, some people think, of putting it into English as to how a directional coupler works.
Repeater, time out.
When it comes to what ham radio will really teach you, learning about antennas and transmission lines is a big factor of what hams do and the educational portion that we get from each other. The next biggest thing that we could be getting from each other, and we don't, is what is a directional coupler. It's a very simple passive device that does an awful lot of magic. And the courses almost don't teach it. The electrical engineering courses don't teach it. It is just barely mentioned in any of our ham radio manuals, even in the ARL antenna book. Indirectly, it's there in the ARL antenna book because they'll show you schematic diagrams of things that you can build to build a standing wave ratio indicator for your system. And a standing wave ratio indicator really is a pair of directional couplers. There's one directional coupler sampling your forward power, another directional coupler sampling your reverse power. The ratio between the two, properly mathematically manipulated, is the standing wave ratio of your system. And you're trying to make that as low as possible, because the magic of a transmission line is that if it's a 50-ohm transmission line, and if your antenna presents itself as a 50-ohm resistor, pure resistor, then all that 100 watts you're generating goes down that transmission line, all of it goes into the antenna, and it goes flying off into space, and none of it comes back. But if that antenna is anything but a 50-ohm resistor, if it's a 25-ohm resistor or a 100-ohm resistor, you've got a 2-to-1 biswar. If it's a 50-ohm resistor along with some capacitance or some inductance, there will, in any of those cases, be a real standing wave ratio, a fancy way of saying a certain percentage of your transmitted power going to the antenna doesn't get there, reflects right off the front door of the antenna, and comes flying back to your transmitter. So your directional coupler, dual directional coupler, bird watt meter, standing wave ratio indicator, antenna analyzer, all of these devices.
Repeater, timeout.
And I was starting to list devices, but the Cadillac of devices is a vector network analyzer. You study what's inside of every one of those, including the vector network analyzer. It is a series of directional couplers. A directional coupler is a fancy piece of electronics. It's amazingly simple. John has held a few of them taken apart in his laboratory because they got dropped and damaged, and he took it apart, and he looked inside, and he said, gee, there's nothing there. How can such simple circuitry do that magic? The magic it does is that a directional coupler set in the forward mode, when properly adjusted, is sensitive to the signal flowing in the forward direction, going up toward the antenna, and it does not see any of the signal reflected. You flip that directional coupler around, front to back, or you use the second one, and it now senses the signal coming back down from the antenna, reflected, and it doesn't see any of the power going forward. I mean, at first it sounds like it's a violation of reciprocity. How can something so simple do that much magic on a transmission line? And once you study a directional coupler, it's not rocket science, but it's one of the best-kept secrets in the world of our radio electronics. It's the most highly effective detecting device that we ever want to use, in my opinion. If you ever got a transmission line and antenna and you want to know what's going on, The bottom line is you're eventually going to be used a directional coupler, whether it's inside your Bird Model 43 watt meter, whether it's inside your standing wave ratio indicator, whether it's inside of your antenna analyzer, whether it's inside of your vector network analyzer. No matter what the hell you're using, when you want to make a measurement of that environment, you're going to be using directional couplers. And if you make the investment to learn how that very simple device does all of that magic, you'll suddenly say, wow, with a dollar's worth of stuff, I can build that. I can add it to the output stage of my transmitter, the output stage of my
repeater. Time out.
As you can tell, I'm getting emotionally involved as I'm typing out the machine multiple times in a row. But if you make the investment to learn how to do that, you're going to eventually say to yourself, how in the world have I lived this long without having that knowledge in my head and that device in my hand installed in my shack? How in the world have I lived this long without that, when that very simple device does so much magic and it's the world's best kept secret? The courses don't teach you. The ham radio manuals do a very poor job of teaching you. And except for places like the TechNet, you're not going to hear about directional couplers. But you find that article in k5rmg.org by going to the, as I said, the Wayback file, because those guys eliminated that from their website. I'm very disappointed they did that. And maybe I got to talk to Tom Williams, w1mba.org, and putting that back onto his website, putting that onto his website, along with my article about getting the best impedance match for a Yagi antenna. Anyhow, once you discover how that works, you'll discover that what you think is a simple directional coupler really is, inside of each directional coupler, a dual directional coupler. You didn't know that. I'm going to give you the secret. Make sure you don't tell anybody. Can you drop? Every directional coupler you have ever used really is a dual directional coupler. But there's a catch. The signal that flows in the wrong direction goes into an internal termination. There's a 50 ohm resistor in there sucking up the power that goes in the wrong direction. Every directional coupler must have that. The non-terminated port, the third port, is the one that's giving you the sample of the signal that's flowing forward or reverse. Now, let me show you what's happening. Assuming now that the meter movement, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air. I'm assuming the meter movement on the Bird Model 43 watt meter requires, I'm picking a number out of the air, 50, let me pick a number.
It's 30 microamperes, Dick.
Yeah, that's the microamperes, but there's a real amount of power. If we know the impedance of that meter, if it's a 50 microampere meter, maybe it's got 1,000 ohms. 50 microohms, 1,000 ohms, 50 microamps, 1,000 ohms, we can figure out what that is. Let me pick a number out of the air. Let's assume it's 100 milliwatts. In other words, your slug on your Bird watt meter must supply 100 milliwatts of power. It can't be that high. Let me make it 10. It's got to supply 10 milliwatts of power into that meter to give you full-scale deflection. Okay? So that when you're using the, let me pick a number, the 1-watt slug, and it's picking up the sample of 1 watt, it's picking up 10 milliwatts of it. It's really a 20 dB directional coupler, so to speak. So it's picking up 10 milliwatts of sampled power when you're running 1 watt with that 1 watt slug, and of the directional power it picks up, it rectifies it, sends it to the meter, and there's the 50 microamps that moves the meter movement. Let me drop. And if your antenna happened to have a short circuit or an open circuit, so that there's a 1-to-1, an infinity standing wave ratio, a 1-to-1 ratio of reflected power to forward power on your system, and you could easily do that, just disconnect the antenna, if you know what I mean, where you go 1 watt forward and 1 watt coming back. And so therefore, the meter is picking up 10 the slug is picking up 10 milliwatts of that in the forward mode, rectifying it, sending it to the meter, telling you you've got 1 watt forward. The reverse mode in that case would also be picking up 10 milliwatts, and the 10 milliwatts would be going into the internal termination of the slug. 10 milliwatts would be absorbed. If you make the mistake of putting a kilowatt instead of a watt into that meter, because you really want to measure this very carefully tuned, very low standing wave ratio of your moon bounce antenna when you're putting 1,500 watts into it. You're not putting 1 watt, you're putting 1,500 watts. 1,500 times 10 milliwatts, I think it's something like 15 watts. In other words, that internal termination, which is probably a quarter watt resistor, 50 ohm quarter watt resistor inside of the slug. When you now use that 1 watt slug in the reverse mode, but still that termination has to absorb the forward mode, you're now putting 15 watts, if I did the calculation correctly, into that quarter watt resistor inside of the slug. If you exceed the 10 to 1 ratio that was recommended, it's a very good ratio, and he's exceeding it by 1,500 to 1 in my example, you're going to burn up that internal termination in the process, because every directional coupler is a dual directional coupler, and the signal flowing in the so-called wrong direction, let me drop it, in the wrong direction, must go into that termination. And now, you're burning up a quarter watt resistor that's buried inside of a slug that's very difficult to service. Yeah, there are ways that a smart guy can take the slug apart and try to fix it and hope he hasn't violated the calibration and the warranty and everything else on that slug. And so that quarter watt resistor that's in there, you can easily burn it up by misusing this ratio of slug power versus power you're testing. And yes, you can replace that resistor, but in the process of that resistor becoming a short or an open, your rectifier circuit probably got overloaded. You may have blown out the rectifying diode. In the process, you may have damaged the meter itself. All kinds of nasty things can happen if you violate this 10 to 1 ratio. This is only 50% of the story, but I think you can start seeing the direction I'm trying to lead you guys into, the understanding of why you don't want to do that on this very valuable instrument called the Bird Model 43 watt meter. Let me send it back to you, John, because maybe it becomes a little bit more clear now. Maybe you got some more questions. Darn good question, by the way, John, because this is one of the most used instruments that's so often misused because people don't understand the theory of operation and the physics of what's really happening. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yes, that's why I called Bird, because I wanted to get some hard numbers on that. And a tenth is the way to go. The only thing you have to do, whether you're using a dual slug meter or a single slug meter, is to remember when you're using that one-tenth of an element compared to your forward power element, you do not want to put it in the forward direction. You can damage the bird. So that you would leave in the reverse mode, and that will handle it, and you will not damage your meter, and you can monitor it continuously. It'll work fine. But it was just something I was wondering about, because so many people have damaged these watt meters and done some cruel things to them. But as long as they stay with that one-tenth, 100 watts forward, use a 100 watt slug, on the reverse slug, 10 watt is fine, and you'll never run into trouble with it. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Very fine, John. You came through beautifully. If you guys are hearing anything you think that shouldn't be there, do hit the reverse button on your transceiver. Listen to the input frequency. Tell us at the time, and what did you hear? How strong? You get a directional antenna. Tell us what direction it was aimed in. And so send that to rfi@limoc.org. And Eric, KE2EJ, and Andy, W2CDL, are gathering those pieces of information in order to find out where that interference is coming from. And so what's going on here? Now let me go back to John's situation. Let me drop. John, you go to that website, qrz.com, and you dial KC4, KC2, here we go, KC2WGB, and you look at those pictures of his beautiful laboratory. As beautiful as that laboratory is, he never has enough stuff. So he's been acquiring more Berg watt meters and slugs for them, because he's running an extremely good experiment. Over the last 6 months, there have been some fairly heated discussions, some fairly strong agreements and disagreements as to what really happens on a transmission line going to a less than perfect antenna. If you really have some standing wave ratio from your antenna and some reflected power, your transmitter is going to become unhappy. A modern day transmitter, a so-called no-tune transmitter with its solid state final stage, they rarely can tolerate more than about a 1.6 standing wave ratio, 1.6 to 1. Before the rig will start turning itself off, cutting back in power, giving you a warning light on the front panel, and so on. And your antenna tuner, if you've got one, has to take over and try to correct that. So you're getting some reflected power from the antenna because the antenna is less than ideal. And a significant number of people, maybe half of them, really smart people, think that if you change the length of the transmission line, that reflected power will go away. They really believe that. And so there's been a fairly heated discussion on this repeater on that exact subject. Therefore, John volunteered to acquire the test equipment and run the real experiment. John has a philosophy that one good experiment is better than 1,000 theories and 1,000 diagrams. So he's acquired the bird slug. He's got multiple bird watt meters, and he's going to be running the experiment that was originally requested by one of our listeners, saying that if I've got a bird watt meter right at the antenna at the top of the tower and another one in the shack, will they read differently? And if I follow the advice of the people who believe that if you change the length of the transmission line, add an extra chunk of cable to the line, that the bird watt meter in the shack will now read a lower number, and if the one in the shack reads a low number and the one at the antenna reads a high number, where's that power going? There's a whole lot of questions here. I'm of the philosophy you cannot change standing wave ratio by simply adding or subtracting the length of the transmission line. The problem is at the antenna. If you don't correct it at the antenna, you're always going to have reflected power. You're going to have the standing wave ratio. And then you can use an antenna tuner. And the antenna tuner does a beautiful job. Let me drop it. Of essentially correcting the situation where the transmitter now sees 50 ohm resistor. It sees a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. The antenna, the transmitter is going to be happy as all hell if your antenna tuner, after it, between it and the antenna on that transmission line, is doing its job. And then there's at least two philosophies of life on this one. I've been writing a series of articles for the microwave reflector on this subject in the last month. The people who are going to run the microwave update conference that's going to be held in Kentucky next month are requesting that I give them a copy of that article so they can add it to their manual that they hand out of presentations are going to be taking place at the microwave update conference that's going to take place in Kentucky. And all of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the organization which is running it. And by the way, there's also going to be a 21-meter diameter radio telescope that's going to be used by Dr. Tom Williams, WA1 MBA, who is Mr. 78 gigahertz these days. He's had a 3 or 4 year project to help people build amplifiers for the 78 gigahertz M band, 78,000 megahertz. So he and his group of buddies have gotten together and fabricated these amplifiers. He's going to be using one of those amplifiers, and for the first time in the history of mankind, to my knowledge, he's going to use a 21-foot diameter dish during the conference and attempt to do moon bounce at 78 gigahertz using half a watt of power. The average guy doing moon bounce on, say, for instance, 2 meters, does it with 1,500 watts. And with a special temporary authority from the FCC, sometimes he uses more power than that. And so with half a watt, and that dish, in theory, the 21-meter dish, which is, what, 65 feet in diameter, in theory has 82 decibels of gain.
Repeater, timeout.
If all goes well, it's going to be lighting up a spot on the moon 150 feet in diameter. And if Tom is successful to swish that boomer, that beam of the move the dish in azimuth and elevation and find the hot spot on the moon where you can find a corner reflector, you know, a valley, so to speak, that's 150 miles in diameter that gives him a good strong echo, then his project will be successful. He's really pushing the edge of the yard. Just because of Earth's rotation and the fact that the moon's in an elliptical orbit and it's slowly moving in and out compared to apogee and perigee with the Earth, that alone gives him, at 78 gigs, a Doppler shift of 100 kilohertz. Can you imagine using a receiver with a kilohertz of bandwidth and you're trying to compensate for 100 kilohertz of Doppler shift because you're on a rotating Earth and because the moon is slowly moving in and out from your point of view, if you know what I mean? You have to look 100 kilohertz uprange and try to find that super weak signal that's being Doppler spread. He's going to be using some fancy equipment, a waterfall display, 100 kilohertz wide, looking for that weak signal. So some state-of-the-art work is going on. But my point of all this is that I've been writing articles about the standing wave ratio and correcting it. And believe it or not, you put a feed horn in front of a parabolic dish, and just the echo off the dish, a little bit of it doesn't all go into space. Some of it reflects back to your horn, and the horn sees standing wave ratio because you've put a parabolic dish in front of that horn. That in turn changes the impedance that your super low noise amplifier connected to that horn sees, and therefore its performance goes down the tubes if you don't correct for it. And so can you just simply move the horn to a different distance? Can you simply move the horn to a different distance and correct for that? Absolutely not. And so so John is doing this experiment of changing line length to find out whether or not the standing wave ratio does go up and down. And once he reports those results, an awful lot of the people who had one philosophy, of course they're not going to accept it at first. They're going to say, well, something is wrong with the experiment. To which John is going to say, okay, visit my laboratory, tell me what I did wrong, why do I don't get your particular predicted performance, if you know what I mean. So standing wave ratio is something that anybody with a radio transmitter, all ham radio operators, will live with. It is a very controversial subject. Of all the subjects that are discussed on the technical net, standing wave ratio is one of the ones that comes up year after year. And so I wouldn't be a bit surprised that we've discussed it 50 times in the last 31 years of this particular technical net. And it's something that we learn to live with, we learn to correct it, and there's lots of theories as to what's going on. One of the hardest things to believe, let me drop it. One of the hardest things to believe is the transmission line does some magic. Whenever you've got standing wave ratio, you've got signals flowing in both directions on the transmission line. The magic of the transmission line is that the signal that goes forward and the signal that comes back do not get mixed together. Every transmission line that's running in a linear manner completely keeps separate the signal flowing forward and the signal flowing back. It does not mix them together. The air in the room that you're in does the same thing. You've got signals from CBS and you've got signals from NBC flowing through your room. Those two signals mix together and never interfere with each other in any way in the air of that transmission line, so to speak, of that medium of transmission. All linear mediums do that. Don't mix the signals together. Only when you use a slotted line and you mix them together in the probe of your slotted line do you really see standing wave ratio for the first time. You come up with this thing that you call standing wave ratio. It doesn't really exist on the transmission line itself. There's a whole philosophy of what's going on that. Is it impedance mismatch or is it signals being reflected? And each person chooses to be in one camp or the other. He argues from that point of view. And his whole philosophy of radio life is based on whichever one of those camps he jumps into. And do those two groups of people talk to each other? Most of the time, no. I've written an article where I tried to get those people talking to each other. And they want to republish that article. You want to say something on this one, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW, go ahead.
I just want to go back to the guy who's going to do moon bounce at 78 gig, and you said a half a watt power. I've never gotten that. Why don't they go 1 watt, 5 watts, 20 watts, 1,000 watts? Why are they fooling around with low power, you know? Is there a high rate of electrical power for Kentucky or something? You know, just kidding, but why do they always do that thing?
First of all, none of the ham radio operators on planet Earth to date have listened to their echoes on any frequency higher than 47 gigahertz. And that was even done only a couple of years ago. And it was also done by the same guy. Okay, so a brand new breakthrough is, in theory, going to eventually take place. 78 gigs is going to be used for the first time. I'm going to throw the ball back into your court, Paul. How many transmitters do you think you can buy that can put out more than half a watt at 78 gigahertz? Who's got that on the shelf? How many kilobucks are you going to pay to buy it? What Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, has done for the last 3 years, he and his merry group of guys have been contributing their dollars and man hours and access to fancy laboratories to fabricate with microelectronic circuits their own homebrew, so to speak, very professional looking, by the way, transmitters, amplifiers, would that have up to half a watt of capability at 78 gigs. They have just created that device. There ain't no tube that comes within a zillion miles of getting up to 78 gigs. You can't do it with a tube. You can barely do it with a traveling wave tube amplifier or a Klystron amplifier if you're willing to pay 50 megabucks to 50 kilobucks to get it. That's out of the question. They're using half a watt because that's all they've got. If they use a big enough dish, a 21 meter diameter dish, roughly 65 feet in diameter, let me drop. That's the biggest dish that they can get their hands on. And so at this great big microwave conference, they're going to use that radio telescope. They've gotten permission to use that radio telescope during that period of time. So it's the biggest dish they can get a hold of. It's the highest power transmitter they can get a hold of. It's the most sensitive receiver that they've also homebrewed that they can get a hold of. So they're at the edge of their art of dollars and physics, if you know what I mean. Yeah, it would be nice to use half a kilowatt on 78 gigs. Unless you're the Department of Defense and you've got 50 megabucks to have somebody develop that for you, you ain't going to get there, Paul. Does that make a little more sense? WS2N, K2RI, WNTechnet. By the way, if you want to contribute your money to make them go for the kilowatt transmitter, they'll accept it. Go ahead, Paul.
See, it's about these low power things at the higher frequencies. So I was just wondering what the relationship was. If you have a, it looks like they're designing it. You would think they would design it with final transistors, forget about the tubes. That's another world. But they've got to have finals. They're designing it with half-watt finals. You can't put a couple of them together, a couple of push-pull amplifiers, whatever it is, and bring it up to 1 watt, 3 watts, 50 watts. Run things in parallel. I guess that's the part that I don't get. This stuff is not out there. It's not designed by human beings yet.
Harp is for sale.
Harp is a very high power transmitter. It runs at half a gigahertz. This is 78,000 megahertz. And why don't they put a few more in parallel, Paul, is your question. Okay. The best transistors that Dr. Tom Williams can lay his hands on have something like 10 milliwatts power output capability. He's running something like 50 of them in parallel on that micro-miniature chip assembled under a microscope. He's got something like 30 or 50 of them in parallel now to get up to the half watt that he's running. How much further do you want him to push that technology with his current available dollars right now, Paul? I'm having some fun with you. The number of transistors that you and I can find on planet Earth that have any significant amount of power at 78,000 megahertz, we're on the edge of the art, the bleeding cutting edge of the art here. How many of those do you think you can put your hands on? He's already running something like 30 of them in parallel right now. You see what's going on here, Paul. You've asked a good question. WS2N, K2LIW, the TechNet.
And that's why I believe there's no such thing as stupid questions. Very good. Always wondered about it. I've heard it for years, this guy's running 23 gig, 50, 46, whatever. The numbers get higher and higher. As the frequency's gone higher, lower and lower power, so. Okay, it's just not out there yet. Very good, Dick. Back to that.
Now, in your and my time, Paul, way back in, let me pick the year, 1960, very close to 1960, there was an article in Popular Electronics magazine that if you took the state-of-the-art transistor available at that day, a QN384 transistor, which sold for $100 a piece, and I'm working for Telephonics Corporation in Huntington, and for whatever reason, they were running an experiment in the final testing department where by hook or by crook, they got three of those transistors, $100 a piece, RCA overlay transistors, in their hand. This is a transistor that can barely get up to 100 megahertz and still oscillate. 1960. State of the art in its day. And the guy guy who was the head of the department felt sorry for this poor guy, KQIIW, working for him, and he allowed him to take one of those transistors and run a, let me think now, what was it? A super regen receiver, in order to listen to FM broadcast on a transistorized radio in 1959, 1960. They didn't exist in those days. So to get up to roughly 100 megahertz was very difficult in 1960. Here we are, almost 100 gigahertz, 1,000 times higher in frequency. Here we are, what, 40 years later, and that currently today is the state of the art. 10 years from now, they're going to be higher power transistors by silicon carbide or gallium arsenide with phosphor doping or whatever. There'll be some kind of a fancy device, maybe diamond transistors. They're experimenting with using diamond as the semiconductor product. And maybe with carbon nanotubes, they'll get there. But that's the edge of the art these days, Paul.
Repeater, time out.
As I said, that's the edge of the art. As I said, that's the edge of the art these days, and these guys. And these guys are pushing it right now. And so I give him a 50-50 chance. I've had a couple of emails back and forth with Dr. Tom Williams on this subject. And I try to do thought experiments as to what is the weakest possible signal you can send to the moon. If you use the most sophisticated computer processing and fancy techniques, weak signal Joe Taylor, K1JT, invented these techniques by which you can do moon bounds with very weak signals with fancy computer processing that can dig 27 dB into the noise. You can have a signal come back from the moon that's 27 dB below the threshold of your receiver, and with his computer program, the WSJT program, it'll suck that signal out of that noise and read that signal across the screen for you. And the guys who have been doing moon bounce with great big antennas and great big transmitters in the past, who had to work real hard to get 10 states on moon bounce, all of a sudden a guy with this WSJT program with one Yagi on the roof of his house on 2 meters and 100 watts of power is now doing moon bounce. He can do the 10 states in 2 months instead of 10 years, if you know what I mean. And so the people who have done it the old-fashioned way with earphones listening for that super weak signal and noise, most people are saying, hey, this is unfair. And the only fair way to do it is to have two separate lists, the guys who do it with a fancy computer program and the guys who do it with a real set of human ears. And is each one of those contacts valid? It depends on who you talk to and what your definition of a valid QSO, so if you know what I mean. So the art is being pushed, and that you guys are hearing some of the details of that. And once again, you're hearing where new techniques of electronics are being invented and created as we speak by ham radio operators. And for that reason, the FCC has set aside every single octave up the band, some of this very valuable radio real estate, given it free of charge to the ham radio operators because they do something very useful with it. It allows new kids to get excited and join the hobby. It allows the old-fashioned guys with white hair to do experiments that they would be dreaming about for the rest of their lives, and they build the stuff in their own laboratories and eventually do good things with it. So the FCC is getting their money. They're getting they're getting payback, and that's the reason why they give this great sense of this great capability. You take that very simple ham radio license exam, and you get that FCC license issued to you. It gives you a capability that anybody in the commercial radio world would give their eye teeth for that, and you get it free of charge. And they have to pay $1 zillion to get one single channel of frequency with one type set of electronics that they buy that they're allowed to use on it to run their commercial business or broadcast station or whatever. Alrighty. I think we've answered all of the questions. Oh, yeah. John... got your question, Paul. We got your question. John, it's time we go over to the mailbag. We're late. I'm in my usual verbose mode. Verbose mode. And by the way, whenever in the past we've asked people, when you're listening to the TechNet and you're asking your question, this guy, RIW, and the other people, sometimes they get pretty long-winded. Do you think they should be giving brief answers or long answers? We ask that question of the listeners, and the answer I usually get is, please be more brief. But when you get to my question, I want to know really what's going on. Give me the whole answer. And everybody else be brief, but when you get to mine, give me the whole answer. John, these great questions you get from these new scientists that would make up...